Hi there, it's Jillian, and I want to tell you about Jillian on Love Plus, your way to get even more Jillian on Love each week by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Patreon. You can access exclusive bonus episodes with extras including answers to your most burning questions, advice on all things dating and relationships, and much more. Check out the link in the episode description for more information. Hi there, this is Jillian on Love, and I'm on a mission to teach people how to revolutionize their romantic relationships by transforming the relationship they have with themselves. So whether you're in a relationship, you're single, or heartbroken, I've got you covered. I'm Jillian Turecki, certified relationship coach and teacher with over 20 years experience helping people transform their relationship with themselves through their bodies, breaths, and minds. I have coached and taught thousands of people to become better versions of themselves and change the way they show up for and within their love lives. I am really excited to introduce this next guest, Amy Morin. Amy Morin is a psychotherapist. She's a mental strength trainer and the award-winning host of the Mentally Stronger with Therapist Amy Morin podcast. She's an international best-selling author. Her books, including 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, have been translated into more than 40 languages and sold over 1 million copies. I am a huge fan of hers. I've read all her books. And so I am just really excited for this conversation. The Guardian dubbed her the self-help guru of the moment. Forbes calls her a thought leadership star. And People says her book is one of the top 20 must-read books of all time. Her TEDx talk, The Secret of Becoming Mentally Strong, is one of the most viewed talks of all time with more than 23 million views. And we talk mostly about her latest book, 13 Things Mentally Strong Couples Don't Do. And, you know, this is such a good one. And we talk a lot about what it means to be fixing, to be the fixer in a relationship, how to stop being the fixer in the relationship. We discuss ultimatums if people are not changing. We talk about growth. So I think that this is going to be a big hit with all of you. I think this is going to be incredibly interesting. So without further ado, my conversation with Amy Morin. Amy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, Jillian.
I am a huge fan of yours. I love your books. And I'll never forget years ago buying your first book, 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Don't Do. I felt very emotionally connected to that book because I had gotten it when I was getting over just an emotional catastrophe in my life. And you describe, I mean, you've been through a lot of loss. And so it seems as though all your books are really derived from your experience of loss. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. Like the worst day of my life, the last thing I wanted was a list of what to do. Because people are always like, why do you write about what not to do? Seems much more manageable to say, just don't do these certain things. But on the other hand, like I don't want people to think that reading this book or working on mental strength is just about like bracing yourself for the other shoe to drop. It'd be awful if we went through life just thinking, I'm going to work on this because something horrible is going to happen. So the good thing about mental strength is it comes in handy on the good days too, that it really makes you enjoy life better, even when life is going well. But yeah, originally as a therapist, I had no intentions of writing this book, but it came out of a series of losses in my life. And I wrote it because I needed it myself, not because I'd mastered it, but because it was the things I needed to work on too.
Yeah. So did you become a therapist because of everything that you went through? Why don't you tell people a little bit, if you don't mind,
sure,
of what you went through
sure.
So people know? Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, I was a therapist first.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I'm so grateful for that because had I not been a therapist, had I not known a lot of these things, I would have struggled so much more. But I was 23, became a therapist and thought, oh, this is great. You know, I got my first big job and life's looking pretty good. But my mom passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. She had a brain aneurysm. So she was here 1 minute and gone the next. Mm. And that experience with grief and loss and trying to, she and my dad had been together since they were teenagers. So to see my dad alone, it was difficult to say the least. And like a week and a half after she passed away, my dad's house caught on fire. It was like one thing after another. And I just thought, oh gosh, I'm a therapist. I should know how to deal with this stuff. And it was a struggle. I mean, just dealing with all of that and thinking about all the things I was going to go through now as an adult that my mom wasn't going to be there for. And really had to work on myself. It was one of the first times I had to say, all right, it's not just about teaching people these skills in my therapy office, but how do I apply them to my life? And it was 3 years to the day that my mom died, that my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack. And I wake up, I'm a widow, I don't have my mom, and I'm supposed to be a therapist who helps other people deal with their problems. And I don't even have language even to this day to say what that period of my life was like, other than to say it was incredibly dark and awful. But the grief and the pain is still somewhat indescribable. And it was years of pulling myself out and figuring out what am I going to do and which way is up and which way is down. And all of these dreams and hopes and things that I had thought my life was going to be like were gone in an instant. And it took a long time to dig myself out of that. Was fortunate enough to find love down the road. I found love again, got remarried, got a different house. And I was like, whoa, here we go. Like, life is going to be good. And it was then that my father-in-law got diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I just remember thinking, like, this isn't fair. I literally just spent a whole decade of my life grieving. I have like nothing left to grieve. And why is it that when something good happens, something bad happens? And I was feeling all sorts of awful things again, knowing that this person I had just become very close to was not going to be around much longer. So I wrote an article. It was really a letter to myself about what mentally strong people don't do. Because in my worst day, I thought the last thing I need is a list of what to do. But if I can just focus on what not to do. And it was things I had learned from a lot of my therapy clients. Like, hey, people who don't do these certain things do better in life. So I wrote myself this letter of what not to do. Found it helpful. Put it on the internet. Thought like 5 people would read it. But 50 million people read it. And and got a book deal out of it, which is why I still get to speak about mental strength today. Incredibly grateful for it. But it did. It all came out of a place of incredible pain. I had no intentions of turning it into a book and certainly didn't think I'd be here today speaking to you about mental strength 10 years later. But here I am and grateful for that opportunity that something really cool was able to come out of something that was a really dark place in my life for so long.
Do you think that one of the keys to overcoming trauma, and what I mean by that is the most intense grief ever. I'm no stranger to grief either. I don't have that story, but I've had all my parents die and, you know, die too young and whatnot. So, and when I say all my parents, I mean stepfather too. And I've just dealt with a lot of loss, but grief is a funny thing. It changes, but it never really goes away. It's just, I think you just learn how to relate to it differently. I think it just doesn't consume you. It doesn't feel like you're being swallowed into like a dark hole, you know, a dark abyss. But I too started my career based on pain. And I have to say, like, changing the meaning or creating something out of the pain and learning, I don't know, there's something about emotional pain and grieving that can really spark creativity in a person. And I think that it's because we're desperate at the time. It's like, let me write this thing because I'm desperate right now. And I really, like, I'm trying to claw myself out of hell right now. And so let me create something. And then that something becomes something that helps, in your case, millions of people. For you personally, does it change the way that you relate to the trauma?
It does. I think it changed me as a person. Public speaking used to be my number one fear. I wouldn't have in a million years for $1 million gotten up in front of somebody in, like, you know, a room of 10 people. Like, no way in heck would I have ever done that.
Oh, no.
Because of what I went through, like, it's really not a big deal anymore. Like,
isn't that crazy how that happens?
Yeah. So it's changed me as a person. And because of that, I can acknowledge, like, I'm not thrilled that I had to go through all of that. It doesn't, the fact that I get to write books and do cool stuff, like, it does not make up for it at all. It's not an even trade. I wish I hadn't have gone through it. But because I did, I think I now have more compassion, more empathy. I can do more things than I used to be able to do. Things that used to scare me aren't scary anymore. So there is some things that came out of it. And with that said, though, I see some people who they go through trauma and like the next day, they're like, oh, I learned so much from it, because they feel a pressure to say I grew from it and I found meaning and purpose. My life is great. But it's, they didn't really do it. They just feel like that means they're mentally strong. Mm-hmm. So I want people to know, like, you don't have to necessarily transform your whole life. You don't have to save the world just because you went through something awful. But finding some sort of meaning, and meaning might be not, hey, this all happened for a reason and now I have this amazing life because of that awful thing. But sometimes it's just saying I have knowledge or skills or tools that I didn't have before, or I now know something that I didn't know 10 years ago because of this. And sometimes that's what helps us say, all right, I came out of this and maybe I'm scarred. I'm not the same person I used to be. It doesn't mean that you come out of it unscathed, or you can say, hey, I'm a much better human because I went through this, but I'm a different person. And here's what I now know because I went through it. And I know for me, that's been huge, I think. Again, like the thought of years ago, I wouldn't have gotten on a podcast. I wouldn't have ever gotten on a stage in front of people. And I gave a eulogy at my husband's funeral. And that was the first time that I said, you know, public speaking's not that bad. It really puts in perspective to me. Perspective. But, yeah. And then to be able to reach back and help somebody else who's in a place of pain now. And like, I know what that pain feels like, but to be able to then say, and now I'm in a position to be able to help people. And that makes me feel so much better, just to say, you know, I've been there and people helped me when I was down. And now I can turn around and help somebody else. And I think paying it forward. Because I can remember people being like, trying to offer me things. And I'm like, I'll pay you back, or I'll help you back out someday. And I remember somebody saying, like, just pay it forward. And now I can like pay it forward to somebody else. And that certainly helps as well.
I so incredibly relate to that. And yes, I do want to echo your point. It's not about completely transforming your life and writing, you know, bestsellers and being on podcasts. It could mean you learn some new skills. It could also mean, you know, you learned who your true friends are, and you learned the value of friendship mm-hmm. in a way that you didn't understand before. It doesn't take away the scars, but it provides some sort of comfort, and I'd rather focus on that. And yes, and the perspective is huge. I remember this is such an example on a much smaller scale, but I've been a yoga practitioner for over 25 years, and I taught it for almost 20 years. And years ago, when I was trying to learn how to do, it's called a forearm stand. You go upside down, but you're on your forearms in the center of the room. I had so much fear, and I saw all my peers doing it. And I thought, I mean, it's ridiculous, but I thought less than about myself. I was like, why don't I have this ability? And I knew that it was fear holding me back, and it was very frustrating. I went through a breakup. It wasn't like an emotional catastrophe breakup, but it was kind of crappy, and I was feeling very down. And I don't know. And then I just did a forearm stand because I was like, fuck it. I can do this. You know, and it's a much small, tiny scale comparison to the public speaking. It's like, forget it. Now I can do it. And so it's a weird thing when things happen like that. You're like, if I can deal with that, you know, I can do this.
That's it exactly. And I like that. And I like the idea too of what you said earlier about sometimes you just find out something about your friends, or learn something new about yourself, or to look for the positive things that do happen. And I'm not into the whole toxic positivity thing either. No. You don't have to look for all the amazing stuff when you go through something bad. But boy, the people that came through for me in my life was just like, wow.
Yeah.
When I was going through tough times, you know, the people that say, let's go to lunch and drag you, or the person who says, you know, let's here's some groceries. Those little things make such a big difference. And to be able to look for that and then say, all right, maybe I'm stronger than I thought I was. Like if somebody had said 20 years ago, this is what your adult life is going to be like, I would have been like, no, thank you. But to know that I could get through it, like, all right, tough times are tough, but I was able to get through it. And here I am, because I have two options. The story I tell myself is, oh, I'm a victim and I went through all of these awful things and that was so tragic. Or the other option is, you know, kind of a superhero. I went through all of this stuff and here I am and I'm still here. And when we tell ourselves that story, I think it makes such a big difference of like, all right, I could be a public speaker, or you said I can do this handstand thing. Like,
that's huge. That's huge. Yeah. It goes beyond I am a survivor. It's like, I'm literally a hero. I'm a superhero.
Right.
Because I am actually still standing after all that. Yeah, I love that. I love that. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would be the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? Like, would you exercise? Would you take a nap? Would you read a book? Would you call a friend? Because a lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. In fact, time is our most valuable currency. The question is, though, time for what? If time was actually unlimited, how would you use it? Because the best way to squeeze that important thing into your schedule is to know what's actually important to you and then to make it a priority. Knowing what's important to us and also knowing how to prioritize what's important to us is how we live our lives congruently with our values. And therapy is a way to help a person discover what it is that's most important to them and then how to live their life so that their life reflects what's most important to them. And so if you are thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. First of all, it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge, which is a great, great perk. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/unlove today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/unlove. 13 things mentally strong couples don't do. I love this. I spent almost 10 years working with couples. Working with couples is hard. Yes. I found it very taxing. And so it just turns out that I just now love working with individuals to kind of break their own patterns and find love and whatnot. But there's two chapters that I mean, every chapter is amazing, but there's one that I think is so incredibly crucial, especially for my audience. And that is about the fixing. Like, you can't fix your partner. And you talk about, there's two things. You talk about, we actually absolutely cannot fix our partner, but we can attempt to motivate them and influence them by changing ourselves. And so what I love about what this chapter is that you encourage the reader to then turn the mirror back onto themselves to see how they can change their patterns to create change in the relationship. And I think that this is a very important principle, because people, you know, they come into the therapy office and they think this person has to change and then our relationship will be okay. And never do they think, you know, maybe it's me that needs to change to create the change, and that there's so much power in that. Like, because if the other person has to change, then you're powerless, basically, because you can't control that. But if you can control change in yourself, then you have a lot more power. There was something else, and that's just a jumping off point, where you said some people find their purpose in trying to fix others. Like, they will date or marry people with a chronic issue. I'd just love to hear you talk more about that, because I think that where people get very confused is the difference between accepting someone for who they really are in their totality versus there are some things that they want their partner to change. Where is there the line between accepting someone for who they are and then wanting them to change as well?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question, because sometimes it's somebody's habits, right? Maybe you're married to a smoker, or you are married to somebody who doesn't eat healthy, or they don't pick up the socks on the middle of the living room floor, and you want them to change their habits. Other times it's about changing somebody's, perhaps their personality. Somebody mm-hmm. might say, you know, my partner's really shy and I want them to come out of their shell. My partner has so much potential and they just don't see it in them. So I'm trying to show them that they could really be doing all of these amazing things. And then the person becomes more like a therapist or a teacher or a parent to the other person, which changes the dynamics. This is supposed to be your partner and you're not supposed to be training them in on how to change. And the cruel twist is, the more you try to change somebody, like, the more they dig in their heels and they don't change. And all of those strategies that are most often used, whether it's lecturing, nagging, pointing out somebody's flaws, trying to tell them how they need to change, pointing out how amazing
that
you
book
are
underneath their bed, like underneath their pillow.
Yeah, even those subtle things, or the digs people get in, like in front of, you know, their parents, you're like, well, if they'd only eat healthy. Mm-hmm. And thinking that we're motivating them. What we know from the research is whenever we do that, the person actually starts thinking about all the reasons why they like that thing. So if we took a habit like smoking, and you say to your partner, that's really bad for you, they're like, yeah, like who doesn't know smoking's bad for you? But they also then say, and it helps me relieve my stress. I can't stop doing it right now. Because those words just came out of their mouth, you've now reinforced the fact that they need cigarettes and they're less likely to quit smoking.
Wow. But it's almost because they're trying to defend their position. So they defend them.
Right.
Yes. Okay. That's wild. Yeah.
And people believe the words coming out of their own mouths. So we know from the research, if you were to say, hey, our daughter's going to start smoking, what do you think? And your partner then is like, no, smoking's really bad idea. That actually might help them to quit smoking because they would start to talk about all the reasons why smoking is bad and somebody else shouldn't smoke. But needless to say, you don't want to do that either. You don't want to try to manipulate somebody into changing or anything like that. But you could focus on how do I behave? So let's say your partner is a smoker. Then it says, it's easy to say, I'd be happy if you just didn't smoke because you take smoke breaks and our house smells like smoke and I don't like all of this stuff. But you can't change that. So what could you do? Maybe you say, I'm going to focus on getting healthy. I'm going to go for more walks. I'm going to get more exercise. I'm going to go outside. I'm going to take care of my health. I'm going to take charge of the food that goes into my mouth. I'm going to make sure that I'm going to the gym. I'm doing all of these things to really focus on my health. And that might mean ignoring this bad habit that you don't love. And when we can start making that shift, the other person often makes a change. And in that chapter two, I talk about what's known as wishes and dips. There will be a moment where your partner says, oh, like, I wish I didn't smoke so much, or I wish I didn't spend so much money on cigarettes, or I wish I had the lung capacity to climb a mountain. That is your moment of opportunity to then ask a couple questions where you can say, oh, really? Like, you wish you could climb a mountain. What's getting in the way? And then the person says, you know, I'm smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. I can't climb that mountain. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's your opportunity to then say, you know, what do you want to do about it? But or a dip. When somebody says, you know, if I just didn't smoke so much, then I would be able to concentrate more on my work, or I wouldn't have to keep taking these interruptions. Oh, really? Again, that's your opportunity to just ask some questions. You don't want to lecture. You don't want to nag. And everybody has those moments. But wait until you hear one of those moments of opportunity and then just ask some open-ended questions. And don't make it about forcing the person to change. Just know that motivation comes and goes, our desire to change. There's an ebb and a flow. Everybody has moments of ambivalence and then moments of incredible motivation. We all do this. If you think of habits in your own life of, I'm going to start going to the gym. Monday, you might really want to do that. But come Wednesday, you're all, actually, I don't really want to do that anymore. So just a little bit of understanding of how people change and then knowing I don't have to wait for my partner to make this change for me to live a happy life. Here's how I'm going to do that regardless. And when you start focusing on that and making those changes, the funny thing is the other person often starts to shift naturally too.
Well, that's huge. The decision to focus back on yourself and your life and just say, I'm going to love my life regardless of whether or not they change is huge. I wanted to talk about codependency because I was so glad that you addressed it in your book, because I think that it is one of those things that is used inappropriately and falsely, honestly.
Yes.
But before we get there, I think then what's really important, if I'm understanding your point correctly, is that people need to understand that nagging, control of any form, is not what's going to motivate a human being to change. People change because they want to. People change because there's some positive reinforcement, not negative reinforcement. And so I think that just understanding sort of like the basics of human nature, and then you see why that's not going to happen. And I thank you for differentiating between wanting to change someone's personality versus wanting to change someone's habit. Because when couples get stuck in that dynamic, there's usually like a lot of resentment that starts to build from both people. And then they build a lot of resistance towards each other. And the next thing you know, they're not having sex, and they're not having sex for a really long time because their dynamic has been so poisoned by almost like this parental control. And then like the teenager that's trying to, like, you know, move away from that. At what point does one give an ultimatum, if ever?
Oh, yeah. I think I always caution people about the ultimatum, because rarely does an ultimatum really change somebody else's behavior. If you say to your partner, I can't be married to you anymore because of X, Y, or Z, and or until you change this, I'm not going to be with you. They might change in the moment, but rarely does that behavior stick. And more often than not, what happens is the person keeps doing that behavior, but they just get better at hiding that they're still doing it.
Yeah.
Whether we're talking about something like looking at pornography or we're talking about alcohol. And sometimes people have an addiction. You don't end an addiction in an instant just because somebody said you have to stop. And that's the biggest one I see these ultimatums with, is somebody says. And so what you can do is you can say, for my own mental health, I need, and you can say what it is that you need. And then you can take the action, like, I'm going to move out for a bit. I'm going to do something differently. Which feels a little bit different than the ultimatum, like, you better do this or else, where people
Absolutely.
Feel backed up against a wall and threatened and will often pretend that they're making the change. And they might try. They might legitimately try for a little while. But if they don't have the support in place, if they don't have the help that they need to make the change long term, it's not likely to last.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And also, it's like, it's the same thing. You can't control another person.
Right.
But you can make decisions that are for your well-being and assert yourself in the relationship in that way and explain that. This episode is brought to you by Rocket Money. Have you ever found subscriptions that you forgot about and or maybe even paid twice for and you didn't even realize it? Because I know I have. I know that I have had many subscriptions to many things, like that show that I watched, so I just fill out that form to do a free trial. And then lo and behold, I have like five different subscriptions to different streaming services. And the thing about Rocket Money is that it cancels a subscription for you that would otherwise be time consuming and something to even think about. I love Rocket Money. Did you know that nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Like, that's a staggering percentage. And before I started using Rocket Money, like I said, I had many, and I could not believe it when they showed me what I was actually paying for subscriptions each month. So, and it was just, I couldn't believe it. It was like I was throwing money out the window. So, like I said, between streaming services, fitness apps, and delivery service, it's never ending. Thanks to Rocket Money, though, I'm no longer wasting money on the ones I forgot about. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. It's amazing. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/onlove. That's rocketmoney.com/onlove, rocketmoney.com/onlove. Codependency. You touch on this chapter, and I'm just going to leave it to you to just debunk some myths about it. Because I think that this is really important.
Because it's a hot button for me. Yeah. People use this word as if there's a diagnosis, or if you are codependent, you're mentally ill.
Yes.
And I take this one personally. My grandmother was legally blind and she had schizophrenia. She was married to a man who drank insane amounts of alcohol on a daily basis. She didn't really have a lot of choices in life. She did what she needed to do to survive. She wasn't mentally ill. She was a survivor. And a lot of people would say, well, she was codependent. What else did you want her to do? She was raising four children. She couldn't drive. Back in the 60s, she had very few options and she couldn't work. She was never able to work. And so for me, I think it's always been a hot button when people are like, well, you're codependent. Again, if you are somebody who's trying to survive, you will do what you need to do. And if that sometimes means you had to get somebody a beer in order to not have the children get beaten, like, that does not make you codependent. That means you're a survivor. So
agree. Thank you.
And like, there is no mental health diagnosis of codependency. When we are all in an unhealthy situation, or you're in a relationship with an unhealthy person, it is very easy to slip into doing things that you wouldn't normally do. And I don't fault anybody for that. I think sometimes, yes, we need to work on ourselves, and it's very difficult to do that, sometimes for physical safety reasons, sometimes for our own emotional health. When you are with somebody and the thought of leaving makes you feel physically ill or causes you so much anxiety, it's really tough to do that, especially without getting help. So that's not to say you don't need therapy or you don't need help. You might, but I don't think we should always pathologize people who find themselves in those situations.
I totally agree. And I also think, though, there is, like you do mention in the book, and something that I've worked with many people on, is they do have that habit of getting involved with people who have really big problems. And they think, I'm going to be the person who rescues them. And I think it's an unconscious thought. And I think they derive, as you said in your book, purpose, I think they derive a sense of significance from it. I think that also people do that because they think, if I'm not needed in that way, like who can actually love me for me if I'm not playing this role? And then there was something else that you mentioned in the book that I hadn't considered, but rang true for me personally, because I've done that before, the fixing, which is that sometimes it's something that you wish you could resolve in yourself that you haven't faced. It's almost like you project that onto your partner so that they can resolve it. And in that way, you kind of feel like you're resolving it for yourself. Am I recounting that correctly?
You are. Yes, absolutely. That sometimes we have these unhealed wounds in ourselves and we just really want somebody else to. And we see this not just in romantic relationships, but it's easier to think about in terms of like parents and kids, right? How many parents weren't the star football player, so they're then putting all this pressure on their kids to be that thing that they couldn't be in life.
We
know from some of the research, like that's kind of healing for the parents, incredibly dysfunctional for the children. Like when you think, all right, now I'm kind of making this thing right, or this thing I was never able to do, I want this other person to do, and I'll kind of live vicariously through them. It can feel really good, but it's obviously really bad for the relationship. It's bad for the other person when we put that pressure on them. And in the end, it doesn't really heal us. It just feels good for a little while. But to notice that in ourselves of like, why am I acting like I'm on the construction crew? And here's this thing that needs to be built up and fixed and it's broken. And therefore it's my job to do it. And it's so important to recognize when we're doing that. Cause like you say, a lot of people enter into relationship after relationship with people who need help, and they step in and try to do everything for them without realizing that this is their pattern. And we think that we're being kind, that we think that we're being nice, we're being helpful, or this person, you know, has so much potential if only they had somebody to do these things for them, so I will step in and do them. And then we get frustrated when they're not giving us back. It's not a reciprocal relationship, or we don't think that they're appreciative enough of the things that we're doing for them. And it really sets up this dysfunctional pattern. So it's so important to realize, like, what is it within me? Or what is it I'm getting out of trying to fix this person? And what is it that I need to heal within myself so that I don't feel like I have to always be the one who is doing all of this stuff and not letting the other person do for me, and that we can't have an equal partnership, that it's more about me fixing them. And then I get some sort of satisfaction out of thinking, here I am, whether it's I'm constantly giving somebody money, I'm making their appointments for them, I'm doing all of these things because I think if I do all of this stuff for them, then I'll be needed and they'll need to keep me in their life. Because otherwise, if I'm not needed, then maybe they don't need me around. And what would that be like for me? It would be too lonely or scary.
Yeah. And this is so important because I think that people think, oh, I'm an overgiver. I keep giving. So therefore, the problem is the other person. I'm choosing the wrong people. And it's like, there may be actually truth that you are choosing the wrong partners if you're always choosing people who you believe need to heal or reform in some way. But you're just going to find someone else just like them if you don't look at yourself and see that, like, this is your pattern. And it's not just about choosing a different person. This is about how you show up to a relationship. This is about how you participate in a dynamic that is creating resentment for you. And that is something that you need to be able to see inside yourself. And a lot of people don't want to do that. This episode is brought to you by Base. I love Base. I have a bag. I use it all the time. Lifesaver. Because I don't know about you, but many people, including myself, have tried to fit everything we think we need for like a trip, only to end up with like a suitcase bursting at the seams. I can't stand that. But with Base, there's room for everything. 15 pairs of underwear for a weekend trip, no problem. Deciding between a few pairs of shoes, bring them all with Base. So if you've got any trips planned in the next few months, you do have to check out Base. Trust me, it's really fantastic. I feel like every time I went to the airport before I started using Base, I would notice their bags, the Weekender or their suitcases, and I'd be like, okay, next time that'll be me, because they just look, they look sleek and they look functional and easy to use. And now I can confidently say that these things are very, very true. So right now, Base is offering our listeners 15% off your first purchase by visiting basetravel.com/Jillian. Go to basetravel.com/Jillian for 15% off your first purchase. That's basetravel.com/Jillian. It's so interesting because your last chapter in this book is about, you know, we need to be changing and growing, which is an interesting paradox to you can't fix your partner and whatnot. And I think that, you know, there's so many people who say, I want someone who's going to grow. But what they failed to recognize, and what I certainly have failed to recognize in the past, is that most of us want our partner to grow in a way that feels like we're still in control, that doesn't feel threatening to us. As long as they grow the way that we think they should grow, as long as they grow according to our belief system and blueprint around what growth means, we're cool. But as soon as they want to make like a big change that feels very authentic to them, it can feel very threatening to us. And I think that this is part of the complexity of being in a relationship, which is that sometimes the change that one person makes does have a ripple effect on the relationship that's not always positive. So it's differentiating between you can't fix your partner, they are who they are, but you can influence them to change certain habits. And then also, alongside of that, one must know what their limit is, what is tolerable for them versus what's intolerable. And if there's certain habits that are not changing, in spite of the fact of you doing the work for you to change in the relationship, then you might have a decision that you have to make that doesn't come in the form of an ultimatum, that just comes in the form of protecting your own mental health and letting them know. And then there's the, you know, we all want to evolve and change. But as someone who has been in the so-called spiritual yoga meditation world for so many years, the theory is that all human beings are always evolving. That is something that you cannot actually stop. Everyone has an evolutionary process. It doesn't look the same. But then there's also the colloquial saying, which is that some people just never, ever change. They sometimes even get worse. So I didn't even think I was going to ask this question today, but that reading that chapter made me think of it, which is, what should our expectations be of each other in a relationship of growth versus just tolerating people not changing so much?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think for a lot of couples, you know, growth is important and you want to change and life is going to change whether you want it to or not. For families, you know, the kids grow up and they move out of the house, or for people, there's going to be financial changes over the years. You might change jobs, you change where you live. All of those things are going to happen. Some people adapt to change better than others. Some people are much more resistant to change. Some people just really hate any kind of change. But then you also have like the personal changes that where somebody might say, you know, I think I'm going to get into, we'll take yoga. Maybe the other partner's like, oh, great. Now you're going to become this, you know, spiritual guru who goes around and might be really resistant to that person doing it. And so I think it's about recognizing like how open you are to change, how open your partner is to change, how the changes that you make affect the other person. It could be something simple, like I'm going to start going to the gym in the evenings. Well, that might take away from the time that you and your partner had together. So therefore, it does affect your partner. It might affect your family life. And then maybe you go to bed earlier because you're more tired. So then the two of you don't have that quiet time together in the evenings that you used to have. And just recognizing those little things and talking about it. Like, hey, if you're going to start doing this thing, or you're going to change your diet, you want to become a vegetarian, I don't. Can we still eat dinner together? Mm-hmm. And just trying to have those conversations, because so often what happens is one person makes one, what seems like a little change, like I'm going to become a vegetarian, and suddenly you quit eating meals together. And then before you know it, one person's always in the bedroom and the other person's on the couch and you're both staring at your phones. I mean, it could be something as simple as that that has this ripple effect over time, or a domino effect. So you want to make sure that we're conscious of that and knowing that it's actually good for you and for your relationship to change, for the other person to change. If you're going to be with somebody for 30, 50 years, like, you need to keep finding them to be exciting in some way. Otherwise, yes, it gets boring. And I always tell people, like, boredom is what kills more relationships than anything else. People think it's conflict. It's not. It's boredom. If you grow bored because you think, I already know, I can finish all of your sentences, I know what you're thinking, we do the same date night every Friday night, we've never done anything different, like, your relationship is going to get stale and you're going to put it in jeopardy. You wanted this other person to say, you know, I'm going to try this new thing that I never tried before. I'm going to take a karate class. I'm going to travel to this new place. I'm going to experiment with something that I haven't tried before. Because then you can learn, they'll learn more about themselves, but then you can learn more about them too. And that's what keeps relationships fresh and exciting. But for some people, that feels threatening. Like, I don't even know who you are anymore. You started taking this class or you joined this book club and that seems out of character. That's actually
out of control because they feel out of control. Yeah.
And those are actually really great things for a relationship, for your partner to have interest in things that are new and fresh and exciting. But for some people, that does feel threatening. And so that's the opportunity to say, I'm going to work on myself right now. If I feel threatened by my partner's growth, probably a sign I should work on me.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, I think because people are afraid if they change, maybe they won't find me attractive anymore. They won't love me anymore, you know, or we'll just grow apart. But I love that because I think that it's an opportunity. Okay, well, if they're trying new things and I'm just not trying new things, I better step up. I think that's a part of relationship that people don't talk about enough, which is that, like, the easier thing about being single is that you don't have to be accountable. You know, you don't have to change. You can be totally selfish. You can feel stuck in life and not worry about whether or not that's going to be unattractive to someone. It's not a very fulfilling life if that's why, I'm all for people choosing to be single if they want to, but if that's the reason, that's not really going to fulfill you. What I love so much about this chapter is that being in a relationship really is like you're kind of signing up for a challenge to grow and try new things and to be accountable and not to just stay the same and to be explorative. And I agree. I think that's what keeps passion alive a lot. This episode of Jillian on Love is brought to you by Manu Kora Honey. Manu Kora makes Manuka honey. I don't know if you've ever had that before, but it is a game-changing honey. It is so medicinal, delicious. It's actually a big part of my daily rituals or routines. I just think it's incredible. It's a single-origin honey that comes from New Zealand, where the bees only feed on the nectar of the Manuka tea tree, making honey that is pure, rich, and complex with a creamier texture that is on, like I said, a completely different level from the normal honey you find at the supermarket or even from really good raw honey. It's just on a whole nother level. It's like a superfood. It's super rich in antioxidants and prebiotics. It's 3 times more compared to regular honey. On top of that, it contains an antibacterial compound called MGO that could be found exclusively in Manuka honey. The bottom line is that these nutrients really support and optimize our immune system and digestive health, and it's delicious. Like I said, I am totally addicted, and I cannot recommend this enough. Manu Kora sent me a jar and a squeeze bottle of their MGO 850 Plus Manuka Honey, their best-selling honey. The 850 Plus Honey has this creamy caramel texture that melts in your mouth and is unlike literally anything I've ever tried. I can grab a spoonful out of a jar and literally just eat it like that. So you got to get it. If you head to manukora.com/Jillian, you can get $25 off their starter kit, which comes with the MGO 850 Plus Manuka Honey, a free travel pack, honey sticks, a free wooden spoon, and also a free guidebook. It really is the perfect gift for a loved one. So now I love the jar and a squeeze bottle, but the extra pack of compostable honey sticks is perfect for whenever you're on the go. You can bring them with you when you're traveling or need a quick snack, running errands, and they are just the, kind of like the perfect energy boost if you're out for a run or at the gym or just, like I said, doing your errands, especially this time of year. That's Manukaura, MANUKORA.com/Jillian to get $25 off your starter kit. This is the ultimate honey. Indulge and try some honey with superpowers from Manukaura. How would you suggest that a person speak to their partner who they feel is stuck in a rut and they really want them to feel empowered to grow and change because they're starting to feel kind of bored with them, honestly?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question too about how to have that conversation, because it's not about changing them and saying, hey, get up off the couch. But you can express your concern. And I always say, express it once. You're their partner. So sometimes you'll see things they don't see. So you could say, gosh, I noticed that in the evenings, you come home from work, you sit on the couch and you scroll through your phone with the TV on. And I wonder if that is fulfilling to you or if you might be stuck in a rut. Mm-hmm. Start the conversation and you can express a concern like, you know, you used to do all of these cool things. And I noticed now that maybe you don't feel like doing them. Or I noticed that it seems to feel more like a chore when you have coffee with your friends. You're not excited to go anymore. Mm. Open up the conversation if you can. And then maybe you invite them to do more things, right? Like thinking of signing up for a Chinese cooking class. Does that sound cool to you? Invite them along to do some things. And then again, it's about then you go do those things and then talk about, you know, I feel amazing that I just learned this new skill or that I'm trying to work on this or that I'm reading a new book that I've never read before. And maybe that will inspire your partner too. And knowing that, all right, I'm going to have a conversation that says, I care about you. I notice these things. I'm curious about what you think. If you see it as a problem, I'm going to invite you to do some stuff with me too and see if that helps pull you out of this rut. And then also, I'm just going to go out and do things to make sure I'm not stuck in a rut and see if that also gives you some inspiration or motivation too.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it's like, instead of making it about you, it's like you actually care about this person's well-being. And I think so many people will say, you know, why do you always do this? Or they'll start to think like, they're ignoring me. And they make it all about them as opposed to really genuinely caring about their partner's well-being while also recognizing that it impacts the relationship. You know, it really is important to do our best to take care of ourselves physically and emotionally and mentally when we're in a relationship, because it really does help the relationship. Like the more that we show up for ourselves in that way, I think it really helps the relationship. Because there are definitely people who have partners who are depressed. And it's like that rut is really a rut. And one thing that I always say is, I think it's important to understand why the person is depressed, because maybe it's something like they don't feel like they have direction in life versus the kind of depression where it's sort of inexplicable. And then also, like, where does someone find the balance between, okay, I'm just going to focus on myself and take care of myself and not try to fix my partner, not over-focus on their depression and lose myself and my autonomy in the relationship, versus just not knowing, like, where do we draw the line between trying to help them and trying to help ourselves?
And that's a tough one for a lot of people.
Yeah.
If your partner were struggling with a physical health issue, you're not just going to like step over them and if they're laying on the floor and they're unconscious, right? But then when it comes to mental health issues, we're like, what do we do? How do you get that help? And it's a lot more complex. And it's tough to be in a relationship with somebody who's struggling with a mental health issue. So the first thing would be to notice like what comes up for me and what do I think about that? Because sometimes people think if you loved me, you wouldn't feel this way. Or if I loved you enough, I'd be able to love you out of your depression. If I had done something different, you wouldn't be in this space. Or they end up lecturing them like, you know, just get out of bed, get off the couch, go do something. And none of those things really work. So if your partner has a mental health issues, one of the best things you could do is go get help for yourself. And you talk to a therapist and you say, gosh, my partner has depression. I don't know what I'm doing here. And get some tools and strategies, whether it's all, yes, you should invite them to go on a walk every evening, or you should help them schedule a doctor's appointment. Different things work for different people, and to figure out exactly how severe their depression is probably going to play a role in exactly what steps you take. Sometimes it's a matter of just supporting somebody, having some conversations. Sometimes it might be about calling their doctor. And sometimes that means calling their doctor and not telling them that you called the doctor. I think sometimes there are times when it means I'm going to do what I need to do in order to help you out. I'm going to let your doctor know you haven't gotten out of bed for 3 days, or let's talk about seeing a psychiatrist. So I think it depends. And for people who are really struggling, if you can get therapy on your own, that can be instrumental. Yeah. But I know there's sometimes a 6-month wait list or people have other barriers to getting in to see somebody. So if you can't talk to a therapist on your own, I think it's about trial and error and doing some experimenting. I'm going to invite you to come out for a walk around the block with me. I'm going to ask you, what can I do? I noticed this. What could I do to be helpful? I know that your partner, a lot of the things they do when people are depressed, they tend to be more irritable and they don't have any energy. And we often take those things personal. Like, if you love me, you'd get up off the couch. Or if you cared more about me, you'd be able to do the dishes more often. And that's tough. And it's tough to feel like I have to pick up the slack right now. But working on ourselves, again, it goes back to that and figuring out, how do I manage my own mental health the best I can, given the hand that I'm dealt at this very moment?
Yes, that's great advice. Thank you. I think a lot of my listeners will be very curious to know, you lost your first husband at a very young age, but then you remarried. Was there anything that you did to kind of open your heart back up to that? You know, because it's one thing to go through a divorce. It's another thing to lose the person you love. I'm just wondering if there was anything that you did to find love again, because I think there's a lot of people listening who, you know, they always want to know, like, did you find love again? Like, how did you do it?
Yeah. And it was a bizarre place to be a 26-year-old widow. A lot of my friends were just starting to get married, talking about family and stuff like that and going on dates. And I would have people say, like, oh, you'll get remarried again. And when people would say that, like, it just felt awful because I thought, I have no desire to do that. In my head, I thought it would always feel disloyal or feel wrong. And I couldn't imagine anything more awkward than going on a first date and explaining to somebody, hey, by the way, like, I have a story to tell. Or it's not like my marriage ended because either of us wanted to. It's not like if I had been divorced, I could at least be mad at my ex or something like that. And for me, it worked out well because Steve, my current husband, is somebody that I had known from before. So he knew my story and was still like, okay, that's okay, I'm in it. And my story was more complicated too, because my first husband's family basically adopted me. I'm very close to them to this day. So I was like, they kind of come with the package. And is this going to be weird if we go to eat dinner with my former in-laws? And luckily he was like, oh, there's weirder things in life. I'm in for that too. And they were very much open to that with him as well. Mm. I did things very differently. Like, we got married at a Las Vegas drive-thru. Mostly because I thought, you know, I don't want to have this huge wedding where I'll be happy that I'm remarried, but it'll be a reminder for me and anybody who's there, like, the reason I'm getting remarried is because something very sad happened. And Steve was good with saying, yeah, let's just do the drive-through wedding and make it a fun wedding as opposed to a big wedding, thankfully. So there were so many complicating factors. And I think it was about being open and honest while we were dating. And like, what was this look like? And from a practical level, like, all right, I still have pictures of Lincoln around the house. Or, you know, do we still use the same couch I had in my old house? And having those conversations up front. And he was very, thankfully, he was just very accepting and understanding of, like, you know, I have this box of Lincoln's items. It's going to move with us when we move. Or, you know, his family is still going to spend holidays with me. And he was open to all of those things. His family, his parents met Lincoln's parents. I couldn't have asked for anything.
That's wonderful.
Beyond my wildest dreams of what life could be like. And so grateful for that it made it much easier. And there were many of those feelings of, like, am I being disloyal? And even, like, to this day, it's weird to be like, my first husband, and then you say my second husband. I'm like, is that really? But, like, to say my late husband, I've never quite found the language that feels right. And I'm okay with that. I've just come to that conclusion of, maybe it'll always feel kind of awkward. And that's okay. And I live a very different life now. I live on a sailboat in the Florida Keys. I used to live in rural Maine. And
oh, wow.
I used to have a 9-to-5 therapy job. Now my life is, I get to live on a boat and write books and I do cool stuff. And I still get to be a therapist, but in a different way.
Yeah.
So it feels like a completely different life, but at the same time, it's not. Like, I still found small ways to make sure that I still feel like the same person, and the other chapter of my life is still brought forward in some interesting and fun ways. So And there are things that Steve has accepted. Like, for example, if there's something, because we live on a sailboat, like sometimes somebody has to climb up 65 feet in the air to the top of the mast to do something. I'm like, you know, I'll do it. Not because I'm brave, but because it's easier for me to do it than to watch him do it. As somebody that lost a first husband, I'm like, yeah. I don't want to watch you do anything dangerous because I can't. Yeah. It's less scary for me to just volunteer to do something that... And so people will say like, oh, that's so brave. Like, no, really, it's actually not. It's like, and he accepts that. Like, you know, don't be reckless in life. I don't need to lose husband number two. But I think it's about being open and honest, recognizing my feelings, working on myself and having those conversations with him about, you know, this is what it's like and this is what I need. And trying to also then be understanding of what this must be like for him to marry somebody who was widowed and try to be understanding of his needs as well.
I love that answer. Thank you. Is there anything that you would like to share with the audience? Anything that we didn't cover?
You know, I just think that we're all stronger than we think we are. Your brain will doubt you sometimes. And in relationships, it is complicated to figure out, like, what boundary do I need to set? Where do I need to speak up and say something? And it's complex and you don't have to have it all figured out because life is messy and beautiful all at the same time. And so you can, if you're fortunate enough to be in a relationship with somebody, then to know it's not going to be perfect and that's okay. You can learn and grow together.
Yeah, I think that's so spot on. And yes, it can be very complicated when to know to put down a boundary and when to know to kind of check yourself before you wreck yourself, basically.
Yes, yes.
I thank you so much for your time, Amy. And I thank you so much for figuring out a way to take everything that you've gone through and help so many people. And the way that you write your books are they're just easy to digest and to understand. And that's what people need. Life can be very hard. And so people really do need to know what not to do in order to be strong. So I just wanted to say that I'm very appreciative of your work. I'm very appreciative of you coming on the show. And I look forward to what you bring about to all of us in the future.
Oh, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be here, Jillian. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Till next time. That's it for this week's episode of Jillian on Love. I am so curious to hear your thoughts about this. I thought it was just a fantastic conversation. I'd love to hear from you. And if you could do me a favor and share this with anyone and everyone who you think could benefit from this episode, because, well, number one, the most important thing is you never know whose life you could be changing. And I really mean that. And then the second thing is it's what helps to keep the podcast alive and it helps us continue to share great information that helps people and to get great guests for all of you. So if you have any comments, if there's anything that you want to request that I talk about on the show, please do not hesitate to reach out to me at hello@jillianonlove.com. And I thank you for listening.
Jillian on Love is a Q Code production. Executive produced by David Henning and Steve Wilson, produced by Shin Yin Hu, editing and music by Will Tendy.
I'm Carlos King, one of the most sought-after executive producers in reality television. I am thrilled to announce Reality with the King, where we'll discuss all things reality TV. I have interviewed everyone from NeNe Leakes, Teresa Giudice, and Kenya Moore. Each episode, we will rehash shocking betrayals, honey. Yes! Hilarious shade! And all the drama. Reality with the King podcast is available wherever you get your podcast.
Hey guys, Heather Ashley here, host of the Big Mad True Crime Podcast. If you're looking for a true crime podcast with all of the details and none of the small talk, you have found your people. Each week, we dive deep into a new case and learn everything there is to know, from getting to know the victim and the impact their case has had on those around them, to the investigation into what happened to them and who is or might be responsible. And if the bad guy looks like he might drink whiskey by a dumpster or has the social skills of an ogre, we say it because we were all thinking it anyway. As the name suggests, we get big mad over true crime, and I would love to have you join our incredible community of listeners with big hearts and zero time for small talk. Subscribe to Big Mad True Crime anywhere you listen to podcasts and listen to new episodes every single Monday.